Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our special training sort of work session here. Even though it's not a regular work session or a general meeting, I'll read the vision statement just to remind us what this is all about, why we're assembled as a group, as a council, and so forth. We envision a distinctive community that prospers while and by protecting its natural resources, with a sustainable economy and infrastructure that assures public health and safety while promoting personal development and initiative, and where all members take social responsibility and actively participate in decision-making affecting growth, development, regulation, and enforcement, and in which people retain a closeness with and caring for each other individually and collectively while working together to accomplish community goals and preserve community traditions. So this is the first of a series of trainings, council trainings that we have in mind as a substitute for what used to be about a two-day meeting for the council all together in the council room here and led by somebody from DCCED, our representative there. And lacking that, we have a couple of options. There was the AML training that I've participated in live, and some of the rest of you have signed up to follow up and watch the recorded session. And I strongly recommend that. There was a lot of good stuff in that meeting. You can skip through some parts of it that, where there's some sort of general BS and like the first half hour when everybody's talking about what the weather's doing in Nome or whatever. But you'll find important sessions in there covering things like Open Meetings Act, Robert's Rules and Order and how you operate a meeting, the processes for that are well described by a very experienced city clerk from one of the cities. And you'll find presentations in there on budgeting and legal issues and lots of good things. So I do encourage you to run through that session, and Karen can get you a link to that if you don't have one. For tonight, though, we've got a short set of slides that Tom has put together on local government, and it focuses first on just how we fit into the government structure as a second-class city. Just briefly on that, you get more details in your council binder and in that AML training. But it'll set the stage for the specifics of the operation of our government. So we'll go through that slide set, the general stuff first. You can ask questions at any time. And this is just a discussion thing, so there's nothing formal about it. So please just raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll try to call on you and pick up the topic or expand on the topic as you would like. With the last slide that Tom's got, I'll go through just some of the functions of the city that we have, just a brief review. We will expand more on what each department does in later training sessions when we have the managers of the various sections here to speak in more detail about what they do, but we'll just do an overview tonight. And Kyle has a report from his participation in the in-person meetings with AML up in Anchorage last week. And I'm looking forward to hearing what Kyle has to say about that. And we'll learn a little bit more from Kyle about what AML is and how they service and some of the interesting things that he learned in that meeting. And then our city clerk, Karen Platt, will go through some some procedural things that are useful for us. I won't detail first what she'll do. You'll hear from her. And that's the plan for tonight. Does anybody have any questions about that before? I don't see any hands, so Tom, take it.
Thank you, Mayor. The purpose of this presentation, as the Mayor mentioned, is to provide the Council with an overview of the structure and authority of a second-class city as identified by the Alaska statute. In addition, this presentation will also identify what services the Council has determined to provide for the community. We have two types of governments that the state recognizes, two frameworks. We have general law and we have the home rule, also known as Dillon's rule. Within that, we have organized and unorganized boroughs, first class and second class boroughs. The unorganized borough is unlike an organized borough. Unlike cities and organized boroughs, the unorganized borough is not a municipal corporation or political subdivision of the state of Alaska. Unorganized boroughs were intended to serve as a means of decentralized state services and to foster local participation in the administration of state programs within regions not ready or suited for organized borough status. Article 10, Section 6 of the Alaska Constitution stipulates that the legislature shall provide for the performance of services it deems necessary or advisable in unorganized boroughs, allowing for maximum local participation and responsibility. It may exercise any power or function in an organized borough, which the assembly may exercise in an organized borough, ostensibly to carry out the constitutional mandate that the entire state be divided into boroughs, organized or unorganized. The 1961 legislature enacted a law providing that all areas not within the boundaries of an organized borough constitute a single unorganized borough. And that's where Gustavus sits, is within an unorganized borough. Home rule is the municipal corporation that possesses and can exercise the following powers and not others. First, those granted in express words. Second, those necessarily implied or necessarily incident to the powers expressly granted. And third, those absolutely essential to the declared objectives and purposes of the corporation. Not simply convenient, but indispensable. We also have first-class cities. There's 19 of those within the state. And you can see in home rule, we have 10 home rule cities.
You mentioned home rule cities are chartered.
Home rule cities are chartered. We also have second-class cities. There's 115 of those in the state. The table in front of you is a table of authorized powers and duties under a first-class city. I show this so that we have a comparison on the next slide of the second-class city. Give you a second just to take a look at those powers and duties. And here you can see the powers and duties of a second-class city. You'll notice that most of those are identical to, with some exceptions, except for education. Second-class cities are not allowed to provide the services under any circumstance. the other categories, the other powers and duties, you can see that there's the ability to adopt these powers, but some of them have reduction in the amounts. For example, property tax. A first class city can tax up to 30 mils, that's rate, which is the value of assessed property. And then you have a second class city that can do 20 mils. And it requires voter approval in order for us to do property tax. It's the same with sales tax. It requires the voter approval for sales tax. The last one is other powers not prohibited by law. That's a standard power that is given so that flexibility can be applied in areas where it's not clear whether or not it falls into one of those categories, one of those powers and duties.
One thing that's important about second class cities, and some of you have heard me say this before, is and perhaps the fact that it is attractive to so many communities, 150 some communities or second class cities. A second class city doesn't actually have to provide any services at all. And it can, but it can select those services that fit its community, with the exception that a second class city cannot operate a school. But otherwise, a second class city can do just about everything else that, say, a first class city can do. But we just don't have to do all those services. So Gustavus has a selection of services, but they are by no means encyclopedic. Nothing like a major city or a first class city that, or a borough that has a lot of other services. So that's an important thing about a second class city. There's a lot of flexibility. The cities can adopt almost any power that they are not, well, any power that they are not prohibited from doing, but most have a limited set of services that they choose to provide. So thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Mayor. So cities and functions that the council over the years has authorized us to perform include the following.
Obviously, any city that has employees has personnel to take care of. And in a second class city like we are, the mayor is the is officially the personnel officer unless there has been a, you know, unless you've hired, say, an HR services manager or something to whom that function is delegated. So managing your personnel is a key job for any city that has employees, and most of them have at least one or two. Revenue and finance is covered, of course, by the in our operation by the treasurer. And we have one employee that is the treasurer. So that function is another one of our. Elections are a requirement of every city, and they fall under the purview of the city clerk. So we have a section in our code that deals with elections and the processes that the clerk follows. Those processes, though, are largely dictated by state statute. We have a section of our code called City Departments and Contracted Services. And under that, we have lumped the authority for many of the powers that we have taken. And I can go through those a little more in detail at the end because they're quite a few. We use that section of our code to cover our authority to operate the fire department, the library, the DRC, to provide limited environmental services, land to cover our land operations and so forth. And of course, the public library is one of the key departments in that that is authorized. When we first became a city, it was one of the core departments that the city adopted. Some of the other functions we've added in later years, but the library was one of the first ones. Because it already existed, we took it over from the community association. Fire Department and Emergency Services is one of those authorized departments, and our code provides for a fire chief and a volunteer fire department, and has the authorities written in it to allow us to operate a fire and EMS operation that meets the requirements of various state codes. Waste disposal and recycling is, of course, our DRC, another function that we took over. It was an original function in the city. Our code for covering that section provides for the staffing of it, saying that we will have an operator manager and supporting staff and provides also for volunteers to be used in that operation, authorizes fees and all of that. Road maintenance was one of our core original functions that the city adopted originally. And unlike the other ones that we've spoken of so far, the road maintenance function does not authorize any employees, or it's entirely a contracted operation. And originally it was set up to make use of forest receipts funding for maintenance of the roads. And originally the council wanted to use only Forest Service receipts funding and said that if we ever ran out of that, we would stop road maintenance. But as the city has matured, the code was changed to provide for the use first of Forest Service receipts funds, and we still get some every year, but to supplement those as needed with appropriations made by the council in the budgeting process each spring. Social services is a function that we adopted authority to more recently, I think about 2 or 3 years ago. And our social service powers are very limited. We adopted social service powers for the purposes of supporting preschool and childcare services in the city with funding, but not to run those services. So our authority is very limited and says that we may contract with an outside provider of preschool and or daycare facilities to support them and enable them to operate. But they maintain the responsibility to operate their organization independent of the oversight of the city council. Economic development is our means of covering our responsibilities for supporting the Gustavus Visitors Association. And it provides, it enables us to provide funding to support the Visitors Association. And we have authority in our code to spend up to half of our bed receipts to support that function. But we have no requirement to support them with any money at all if the council chooses not to. Generally, I think every year we have provided support to them, but we have never gone so high as to use 50% of the bed tax. But we see that as an important economic development function. We don't staff it as a city, but essentially we contract and we have a contractual relationship with the Visitors Association whereby we provide them funding. And they have a responsibility to report back to the council on a quarterly basis to apprise us of what their activities are and so forth. So the council has some oversight over them, but they are managed separately and they hire their own staff and they're not city employees. Environmental services is another recent addition to the the authorities of the city. And through the, it's another function that we do not have staffing for. Our code does not provide for staffing, but it provides for us to work with outside agencies, state and federal for the most part, to deal with environmental issues that impact residents of Gustavus. And one of the primary reasons we did this was to allow us to fund operations to deal with the PFAS problems. So that's our primary application of environmental services at this point. So no staffing for this, but the ability of the city to work with outside agencies to meet the needs of the community for and to meet our vision statement for protecting our natural environment. Marine services is in its own title, whereas the most of the ones that I've discussed earlier were in Title VI. Marine services is a special Title VIII in our code, and it authorizes the city to maintain and operate marine facilities at the small boat harbor and the float system out at the dock, provides for us to set fees for use of the facilities, rules for use of the harbor, to do things like maintain the harbor in a clean and safe manner, generally assure that the marine facilities can be used safely and effectively by the public. By the way, for those of you who may not be aware, the small boat harbor, we manage cooperatively with the state. There are three land tracts there. The central tract, which is the majority of the boat harbor facility and has the boat ramp and the area where the most of the skiffs are pulled up and so forth, is actually owned by the state, whereas the two tracks on either side are owned by the city. But the core of the facility is owned by the state. So we have a cooperative management agreement with the state that was originally done to allow us to build and upgrade the facilities there. And we operate it under that CRMA for the marine facilities in conjunction with the state. It's a CRMA that, by the way, is rather out of date because it was mainly aimed at construction of the facilities and I'm hopeful that we will get to redoing that CRMA with the state to make it more a better fit for operations as we do them today. But by the way, the CRMA gives us management authority to the center of the river, though, which is outside of those three tracks that I mentioned. So even if we own the central track, we would need a CRMA with the state to deal with things like the floats that stick out into the water below the mean high tide line. So I anticipate that even if we were to sometime buy that central portion, we would still need a CRMA with the state to manage that harbor. And our marine facilities, of course, include our float system out at the dock. We own the float system, but we do not own the dock. So we have responsibility for managing the floats, and we can set rules out there for how they are operated. We have the authority to even to require permits for their use and to set rules that for the use that the on which the permits are contingent. That is, if users such as charter operators don't meet the don't follow the rules out there, either state, federal, or city, they can be barred from using those facilities under the authority in our code. But we don't own we don't deal with the dock itself. The last section or the next section is property acquisition, disposal, and management and use. And this is a section of our code that it's actually, I think, Title IX. I'm not sure which, but maybe it's Title IX. But it deals, it allows us to buy property or dispose of property. It makes provisions so that, well, we use requirements or provisions in this to buy the property that City Hall is on. We also have authority under this property acquisition, disposal, and management use to set rules for use of properties that the city owns or manages. So we own the gravel pits. We own the City Hall, the Salmon River Park. We own a triangle of property across from Glacier Bay Construction's location on the south side of the road there and between Glen's Ditch Road, or bordering Glen's Ditch Road and the section line that runs across there. So we own that. It's just a forested property. We own the old post office site in that lot. That's all I can think of right now. The gravel pit, though, is one of the main ones, too. So we since we own those and manage them, our rules and our authorities are under the property acquisition, disposal, and management use. Also under that section is the authority to manage the beach park area under the CRMA with the state. There is a section in there that even provides for us to charge fines for various violations, such as parking beyond limits or camping outside of limits. Those are there provisionally. We haven't applied them at this point.
Thank you, Mayor. So these powers are executed by the creation of laws known as ordinance and resolutions. Although a resolution isn't a law by definition, like an ordinance is, it has the effect of a law. The council also creates policy and procedures that helps further direct staff or clarify the ordinances or laws which are to be implemented. Laws can be created either by the council or by the public by petition. City functions and services comply with the authority as indicated in that table, Alaska statutes, and there's a variety of different statutes that apply to each one of those powers. So, council member, also known as a city official. This is a person that holds an elective office under the ordinance of the city. Appointed to fill a vacancy in an elective office is appointed by a city as an employee, such as the city clerk, or as a member of the city board or committee, whose appointment is subject to confirmation by the city council. A city employee could also be a city official. A city employee can also be a council member. Information on the mayor and of the council, including the duties and responsibilities, can be found in Title II, Chapter 2 of the Code of Ordinances. I know that the clerk is going to touch on ordinances and duties and responsibilities in further detail. However, I highly encourage you to look through Title II, all of the ordinances for that matter. And then if you have questions as you're going through them, reach out to the mayor or myself, and we'll help provide some explanation to any of the questions you might have. You can find there's language that you may not be familiar with, or some of the pieces of the ordinance are continued on in policy and procedures, which we could also identify for you so you could get more depth of information in those P&Ps. That's the PowerPoint presentation. Are there any questions? Thank you. Well, at any time, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, please don't hesitate to reach out to staff, and we'll do our best to help you.
Okay. If you think of something, I'm sorry we're not all in one room here. It would be really a lot easier for people to pop up with questions and or think of things that we missed and should have covered. So, but do raise your hand if you got something. In fact, Tanya, do you have? I think I see Tanya's hand up here. Did you? Oh, she didn't mean to. Tanya's happens to be in the room here with us. Kyle, if you're prepared to now, we'd love to hear from you with some comments about what you learned at the AML and what your impressions were of AML. I've never been to one of their meetings, so I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, sure. Can everybody hear me all right?
Sounds good.
All right. Yeah, I didn't have much time to put together any formal presentation or anything. And honestly, going to something like that's kind of getting hit over the head by a frying pan of information and meeting new people and new things. But happy to give a kind of a brief overview and answer any questions. So I'll just kind of skim through some of my notes. I've got probably 15 pages of notes from the event, and I just kind of highlighted some key talking points. So I'll kind of run through like a brief overview of what the few days that I was there looked like, and then open it up to any questions. Does that sound all right to everybody?
Sounds good to me.
Cool. So we'll kind of start with what AML is, and the Alaska Municipal League is a voluntary, nonprofit, nonpartisan, statewide organization of a bunch of cities and boroughs and unified municipalities representing a vast majority of the state's residents. And they became the Alaska Municipal League in 1962 when the boroughs joined. So they represent the voice of Alaska's local governments to successfully influence state and federal decision-making, build partnerships to address Alaska's challenges, and provide training and joint services to strengthen Alaska's local governments. And so looking at the agenda, I actually got in just a little bit late and missed the networking session for the newly elected officials, although I was kind of disappointed about that at first, but then I realized that there was plenty of time to catch up with people. But the idea behind the local government conference is to just bring everybody together from all these municipal officials, including mayors, borough assembly and city council members, municipal managers, administrators, attorneys, and a whole bunch of other appointed officials and municipal staff. And a fair amount of federal officials attend too, but I didn't meet anybody or have any discussions with anybody at the federal level. The conference provides a venue where municipal leaders can share best practices and lessons in innovation, efficiency, and effective delivery of services, and an opportunity for dialogue and relationship building. Just a place to come together and work toward solutions. So there were a bunch of breakout sessions, and it was kind of difficult to decide which ones to go to, which ones were most beneficial. In fact, some of them were a toss-up, and to be honest, I think I might have made the wrong choice a couple of times because they were kind of basic overviews of some stuff I already knew. But one of the big coolest things that we did was in the beginning, we had a session called Untold Stories, and you know, basically it highlights and addresses, hey, we've all been in this pandemic together, and the local governments have been on the forefront of this, kind of working to protect the health and well-being of residents and trying to keep the economic side and the recovery going. And the services that cities and boroughs provide, and keeping all that stuff afloat while trying to balance public safety and all that stuff. And so we went around the room, and it was a big room. There was 400 or so people there, but you know, stories from Fairbanks, Valdez, Bethel, Homer, Kenai Peninsula Borough, Wrangell, Wasilla, Denali Borough, Juneau, Ketchikan, Kotzebue, North Slope, Haynes, and on and on and on and on and on, and a bunch of smaller villages. And my take home there is we've done pretty well. We've been in pretty good shape. There's a lot of other communities that are really, really struggling out there with higher caseloads and their schools being closed and fighting about mask mandates and some businesses closed for good. And a lot of communities have had to hire COVID coordinators. And so when it came time for, you know, me to raise my hand and talk, I was like, well, we've done pretty well. We've had a low case count. We've got a high vaccination rate. We've got a conscientious population. We have good access to testing. We're not on the roads. We can kind of keep good tabs. And frankly, we've got the rumor mill where people who, you know, test positive usually come forward. And, you know, in these other communities, especially ones that are on the road system, you don't really know who's been where or what. And, you know, they tell you to stay home, but here we have a kind of a close eye on all that stuff. So my take home from that was just, we've been really lucky and we've had it really, really good by comparison, not to say that we don't have our struggles, but we have a lot to be proud of in how we've handled it. And we have a lot to be really grateful for. The downside of a couple of those stories, from even those that were talking about how well that their communities have handled the pandemic, is just some of the longer term effects and how to strategize for, say, the mental health aspect of COVID and the lacking of socialization and development and children from missing like a year of in-person learning And one thing that really stuck out to me was the mayor of Haines talking about how they went through that landslide, that big, horrible event that they had, and they lost a couple of community members in the heat of this thing. And then come summertime, they're still grieving and they're still going through this thing that hurt, you know, really, really bad. And he was faced with the decision to have the Southeast Alaska State Fair or not have the Southeast Alaska State Fair. And they decide to have it and they have a minor outbreak. And he just talked about like all the hate mail he received. I can't believe you're going to do this. I can't believe you're going to have this gathering. And he was brought to tears saying like, I can't imagine not having this. You know, our community has been struggling so much with all of this. We needed this. And so we knew that there would be cases from this event, but the implications of not having an event like that, he stands by as being far greater. Couple of the breakout sessions I went to were a childcare and early learning session. I learned about the broadband task force. The awards dinner was really cool. I'll talk a little bit more about that. I went to a session encouraging Alaska business development, a session about ranked choice voting, a session about modernizing Alaska's sales tax collection, which that was a lot to learn all at once. The childcare and early learning, you know, it talked mainly about the importance and how the pandemic has affected a lot of communities, the importance of early childhood education and having an adequate childcare system. And while the networking was nice to tap into some of the resources there, there wasn't anything horribly productive about this. I just learned that other communities with larger populations, you know, seem to have effective solutions to this issue, and smaller communities just like us are commonly faced with the same struggles of not necessarily having qualified staff or a licensed facility or, you know, any real good affordable childcare options. The broadband task force breakout session was interesting. I knew nothing about all of the effort that's been going on there, and I'm still kind of wrapping my head around it, but essentially there was a task force put into, and the pandemic sort of highlighted the importance of having good internet throughout the state. And so there's been a release of funds and a task force dedicated to sort of triage, highlighting areas that need it the most and filling in gaps where it's necessary. The awards dinner I went to, they gave out, you know, awards for the elected official of the year, municipal employee of the year, lifetime service award, emerging municipal leader. And that I was at a table with a couple of guys from the Kenai Peninsula Borough and a representative from FedGov. And we kind of strategized about road maintenance and gave them the rundown of what our situation looks like. And they asked a lot of questions and hypothesized what it would look like for the city to take on road maintenance itself. And then the guy tried to sell me a grader. Encouraging Alaska business development. You know, so many small businesses were affected during this thing, and a lot of small businesses went out of business. And so we heard from the Small Business Development Center and a representative from Buy Alaska. And the take home there was support your local businesses and try to keep things in state. So, you know, instead of shopping on Amazon or, you know, wherever else we get our stuff from out of state, to consider using the resource of Buy Alaska and supporting small businesses, small local businesses, anytime you get the chance. Ranked choice voting. I was hoping to get a really good picture of what it would look like to do individual council seats. But my take home is that it's beneficial to do it that way. And hearing from a lot of the public, I think it's a good system, although it's, you know, got multiple steps and it can be fairly complicated. That's a whole nother world to dive into. And I won't go into too much detail, but it seems like it would totally be an effective way for us to go. And we should maybe consider that discussion later on. Modernizing online sales tax collection. I learned about the Alaska Municipal Sales Tax Program, which I was actually asked a couple weeks ago and was embarrassed to not know anything about that. I was approached by somebody that said, look, it shows here on, you know, an eBay that I'm paying Gustavus city tax and I don't know what that's all about. Are we getting that money and how does that come to be? And so I learned all about the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission and was pointed to their website and then took another look at our budget and the report there and realized that, yeah, that's a new thing. There were a few vendor booths there, and I'm sure some of you have seen, especially the new folks, about Municode, where our code is all hosted online, and they offer a bunch of different services. They would host our meetings if we would pay them to do that. FedGov, a resource for, you know, buying equipment that's government to government rates. And a really, really cool gentleman from a company called Exerplay. You know, since I have kids, I'm kind of looking a little bit more at play opportunities and comparing, you know, what say like Hanes or Seward or, you know, other, even Juno has as far as like, you know, playground equipment. And there's some really, really, really cool stuff out there. And there's some good pros as far as like setup and understanding, how funding works with local governments and also installation of remote stuff. But in summary, honestly, the biggest thing that I got out of this conference was socializing and networking. And I think, you know, it was Karen that said that to me, that like, it was kind of hard to imagine going this year because that would be diminished. And while there was the barrier of COVID, there was health screening, you know, there was either mandatory vaccine or testing the day of, and, you know, everyone was masked up. And so I was still able to get a fair amount of that, although it was kind of weird to be at a place with so many people. It was just awesome to be able to strategize, especially with some of the newly elected officials, and kind of clank a glass and say, here we go, this is what we're in for. And a lot of us are kind of in the same boat, you know, just willing to step up and serve our community as best we can. So hearing from other folks in a similar position to myself was really encouraging. So that was my few days in Anchorage. I'm still kind of processing most of it.
Thank you, Kyle. I'm so pleased that you could represent Gustavus too there. So they get a feeling for the quality that we have on our council and the kind of community that we are. And I'm particularly looking forward to leadership from you in the future on the child development and broadband issues that you learned about. And I think we see here the value of having the opportunity to go to conferences like that. And I hope that in the future, be possible for more of us to go. I was a little shy about it due to the COVID situation myself. So I really appreciate Kyle. Going for Kyle, something he said that triggered ideas from you and that he might be able to have some fresh outlook on?
Sorry, you broke up there for a second. I only caught part of that.
Okay, I was just saying how much I appreciated that that you went and represented Gustavus, and you're the kind of fresh face that we like to put forth to the rest of the state, and we're really pleased that you were able to go and gather the kind of information you did, and I'm looking forward to leadership from you on child development and broadband and any of the other things that you found were interesting. And if there's anybody else who has questions for Kyle from his remarks, we'd like to hear from you.
I have a comment for Kyle and the rest of the council in case they don't know. Kyle had mentioned meeting up with Municode at their booth and the services that they provide. And I can't say enough good things about Municode. I love them. And we did purchase their meetings management system last year. And I just love it. I do all my agendas and packets through that program. I do my minutes in there, taking the votes within the program. And it's really brought us out of the dinosaur age of doing all those things. So Municode's awesome. I'm glad you were able to visit with them.
Cool. Thanks, Karen. Anybody else with questions or comments on Kyle's report and his visit to Anchorage in April? Okay, with that, I'd like to proceed on to our Madam Clerk for her presentation. Karen, please.
Okay, can you guys see my screen okay?
Yep.
Alrighty. So by this time, I think all of you probably have done your little checklist for me, and I'm still missing a few of those forms that need to be returned to me. So this is kind of meant as a little overview of things that you may have read about, and myself and the my duties. And let's see if I can make this thing work now. Okay, here we go. So I've got a lot to cover tonight. I don't really want to keep you too long, but hopefully just generate some, give you some more information to get you going and maybe generate some questions that I can answer. So I'll talk a little bit about myself, because I like to think it's all about me, of course, and then my duties, meetings, we have a lot of them, Robert's Rules, Open Meetings Act, otherwise known as OMA, email, conflicts of interest, social media, records retention, resolutions, ordinance, and policy and procedure. So I started this position in August 2017 with basically very little experience at the time and none with municipalities. I'm a part-time clerk. I work up to 30 hours a week. Most municipalities, even small ones, have a full-time clerk and maybe even an assistant clerk. I work at the pleasure of the city council, and I receive my direction from the city administrator. I'm a public notary. And hang on a second. I'm also a certified parliamentarian. That's the first certification that I received when I was hired. I'm a certified municipal clerk as of 2019. And I'm working on a certification for public information officer. These last three certifications require extensive training. They take a lot of time. A lot of it's free, but some of it does cost money. And I just really appreciate the opportunity for professional development by the council. It's been really fun and I've learned a lot. So a little bit about my duties, again, all on a part-time schedule. And this is just a general overview of my day-to-day world. The biggest, probably most time-consuming thing that I do is everything having to do with meetings. If I'm not prepping for a meeting, I'm doing follow-up tasks regarding a meeting. So with the mayor and the city administrator's input, I prepare all the meeting agendas, the packets, noticing, and along with the mayor, I help run the meetings, act as parliamentarian. I take action minutes, meaning that I only record actions taken by the council, not what was said. I upload recordings of the meetings to our website, and I publish and archive documents approved at meetings. I of course post everything that you see on the bulletin boards, meeting notices, public safety announcements, ordinances, and resolutions. I provide administrative assistance to city departments and you as council members. I work with public relations between the city and its constituents. And I do that through our city website, our news group email list, bulletin boards, and social media. And I'm also the administrator for all of those things. I manage the city archiving, records retention schedule, and public records requests. I serve as the city election registrar, and I'm responsible for calling and supervising all city elections. And I staff City Hall during business hours, 9 to 4, Monday through Thursday, as a point of contact for city-related business through phone, email, and in-person interactions. I also do a few things that might surprise you. Here at City Hall, we, along with the city administrator and Eduardo, the treasurer, we kind of take care of all the light maintenance here and cleaning of all the janitorial duties. I keep an eye on the Sam River Park. I make sure that the tables are brought out in the spring and put away under cover in the winter, and help pick up trash and branches and keep the park a nice space for children and families to use. And during the winter months, when the marine facilities coordinator is off duty, I'll even clean the outhouses at the beach. And that's how it goes in a small town, right? We're all part-time employees here, and we do what we can to keep things working, and that's okay with me. If you guys have any questions, just raise your hand, because I'm going to forget to ask if you have questions. But just because I remembered now, does anybody have any questions about my duties? All right, I'll move on to the next slide then. So meetings. It's a big part of what you guys do as council members. We have two regular meetings every month. And that's our regular work session and our general meeting. The work session is the first Monday of every month at 6 p.m. And kind of the main purpose for this work session is to prepare for the upcoming general meeting. That's the following week on Monday at 7 p.m. So the first thing we do at this regular work session is we kind of go through the draft agenda and packet, making sure that each of you understands what's on the agenda, answer any questions. Maybe you need to have some suggestions on a resolution or an ordinance that's supposed to be on the general meeting agenda and want to do some wordsmithing. all those things can happen here at this work session. As well as anything else you want to talk about, sometimes we'll have other thing discussion items that will be on the notice. And sometimes other things will just come up, and that's what work sessions are for, to talk through things. And then of course we have our general meeting. We also have special meetings, emergency meetings, and executive sessions. So just a little bit more about each one of those. We have actually a special meeting scheduled for tomorrow night. And these kind of come up oftentimes when there's something that's time sensitive that maybe didn't make it on the last general meeting and can't wait until the next general meeting. Special meetings need to be noticed at least 24 hours in advance, but most often we will have enough time to notice it 5 days in advance or more than 24 hours. And in this case, in tomorrow's meeting, we did post that 5 days in advance. A special meeting can be called by the mayor or two members of the council. Emergency meetings happen sometimes as well, although not very often. Emergency meeting is essentially a special meeting that's called with less than 24 hours notice and is held to address something urgent, such as a flood or fire disaster. Other work sessions happen as well, such as tonight. They may be added as needed. They require a 5-day notice. And no official action can be taken in a work session. Like all our meetings, work sessions are open to the public. But what's different about a work session is that no public comment is taken at work sessions. That doesn't mean that a special presentation could be made by somebody other than the council member, or that the mayor may invite somebody to comment because they have, you know, special expert information about something that you guys are discussing. But typically there is no public comment being taken at regular work sessions. Let me just look at my notes real quick to make sure I didn't forget anything. The other thing about meetings is, you know, it's my responsibility to provide you with the materials you need for meetings. But it's your responsibility to attend the meetings and be prepared. So study the materials that you're given, ask questions, talk to the people in the community, and contribute by taking part in the debate that takes place at meetings. The last thing that can type of meeting is an executive session, and these can only take place for certain matters that are not open to the public, and that could be something that may have an adverse financial impact on the city, compromise the reputation and character of an individual. Of course, that individual must be notified and may request that discussion to happen in an open meeting. Matters required to be kept confidential would be discussed in an executive session, and also attorney-client privilege could only be discussed in executive session. Executive sessions can only be convened in a public meeting by motion to enter executive session that clearly and specifically describe the subject without defeating the purpose of addressing that subject in private. That motion would need to receive a second and be passed by a majority vote. And no other topics are permitted in executive session other than what was identified in that motion. So, you know, you may start commenting on something regarding that motion, but you cannot go down a rabbit hole about something else. You need to stick to the topic that was in the motion. And if action is needed on the discussion that you are having in executive session, you may not take any action in executive session. That needs to happen outside of executive session where the public is, where the meeting's open to the public. So you would need to leave executive session, and then whatever action needs to be taken, that motion would need to be made outside of executive session. Are there any questions about meetings? Okay.
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Is there a question? Yep, I can hear you.
So with all of these meetings, not that I'm planning to miss all of them or anything, but how does that work in terms of, let's say something comes up within 24 hours and you physically can't make it? Is that, how does that work in terms of expectations?
That's a great question. Thanks, Bella. So yeah, if you are unable to make a meeting, contact me. There are some rules in ordinance that define how many meetings you can miss. And I think it's 5 meetings in one year, and 3 consecutive meetings. I think you cannot miss 3 consecutive meetings. And that would be like a general meeting or special meeting. Work sessions, there's no rule on how many you can miss of those. But if you're planning on being out of town, it's always good to let me know the dates that you will be gone. Okay. And then so actually one more thing to add to that, Bella, I'm sorry, is that there are excused absences, and that would be maybe for medical or some other extenuating circumstance.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Mike. I'd add that we do try to schedule special meetings when we can, when they're convenient enough for as many of the council as possible. So, and obviously if somebody's off on vacation and we schedule one, that seems like a pretty obvious case for an excused meeting. We do have a requirement for special meetings to make sure that everybody is notified, either by phone or by other notice. So we'll try to make sure that everybody's aware of them. Some things about, we can't use special meetings to run things through that really need a lot of public notice. Something that's controversial in the public, we need to be careful to be sure that the public has enough notice that we're gonna have a special meeting. So we would always try to give them at least 5 days. That 2-day thing is we have had meetings on a 2-day notice at times when we had some deadline we had to meet, but it's always important to make sure the public has enough notice that we're going to have the meeting. And we definitely want to schedule meetings for when all council members can attend wherever that's possible.
All right, are there any more questions about meetings? Okay, so agendas. Oops, let me clicker in the wrong spot. Agenda items are approved by the mayor. Requests for agenda items should go through the mayor. And the deadline for agenda items and packet documents are 10 a.m., 5 days prior to the meeting. This date is generous in terms of meeting deadlines. And respecting the deadline is really important because that's the day that I actually post everything. And if I don't get those documents in time, it just makes for a very stressful to get everything out and noticed that day. And those are the things that I'm responsible for. The order of business is stated in ordinance with an opportunity for the mayor to make changes or request for changes as agenda item number 4. And so I'm sure you guys have seen that agenda item during the few general meetings that you've been a part of. We're going to talk a little bit about Robert's rules. The mayor presides over the meeting. The conduct of the meetings are governed by the mayor according to the city's adopted parliamentary authority, and that is Robert's rules of order. Things to remember about Robert's rules is that we use them at general meetings, special meetings, and emergency meetings. So at work sessions, they're not quite as formal. We can, you can speak whenever you want. You don't need to make an emotion to talk about anything because no action's taken at work sessions. No action item goes to discussion without a motion and a second. You must be recognized by the mayor before speaking. So in terms of Zoom, you would raise your hand and then the mayor, of course, would recognize you and then you can speak. The maker of a motion has the first opportunity to speak. You may not speak twice until all members have had an opportunity to speak at least once. Comments must be germane to the motion. Again, no going down a rabbit hole when you are engaging in debate on a motion. Address council members by their last name. And this can sometimes be hard even for me to remember because we are, we know each other, we're neighbors, we're friends. But the Robert's Rule of Order way to address council members is by their last names. We don't direct council members. We don't address council members directly. When addressing other council members, you must do it through the mayor. So motions are classified into 4 different types. There's the main motion. Main motions brings a matter to the floor for debate and action. There's subsidiary motions. And these motion relate directly to and amend or affect in some way a main motion. Each of the motions listed on the chart in the next slide takes precedence over or ranks above any or all the motions listed before it. And this will make more sense when I bring up that slide. There are privileged motions, and they are motions of such immediate importance that they should, without debate, interrupt consideration of business at hand. They are not related to any pending motion. And then there's incidental motions. These deal with questions of procedure and not related to the main motion at all. They have no order of precedence and generally not debatable. So this is the motions chart that I was talking about, and it can be a little overwhelming at first glance, but it talks about these different categories of motions. Here on the left, they're listed privileged motions, subsidiary motions, main motions, incidental motions, and those also bring back motions, which I didn't talk about in the previous slides. They're ranked. So the main motion is ranked as number 1 in order to talk about anything that you would be voting on. It needs to come forward as a main motion. And then anything above this would take precedence over anything below it. So let's say there's a main motion on the table. Does it need a second in this column? Yes, it does need a second. Is it debatable? Yes. Is it amendable? Yes. And what does it need for the vote to pass? In this case, it would need a majority vote to pass. Here in Gustavus, in our ordinance, it says that we need 4 in favor to pass a motion. So we always have a majority to pass. So let's say you've got a main motion on the table, and you as a council member want to amend that motion. You can move to amend the main motion, and then you would vote on that because it takes precedence over the main motion being below the amendment. So we would have to vote on the amendment, and then we would go back to the main motion and vote on that as amended, and so on up the list of subsidiary motions. So again, there's privileged motions, and these, let's say you have an amendment on a main motion on the table, but then somebody wants to raise a question or call for the orders of the day that would stop what's happening with the amendment and the main motion. And that means that, oh, hey, you're not following the agenda. We need to go back and get back on track and follow the agenda in order. There's incidental motions that can be made in this section down here. And it tells you, you know, if it needs a second, yes or no. Some of these do not need a second. Are they debatable? Depends. If it's an appeal, are they amendable? No. And the chair will oftentimes rule on these incidental motions rather than going to a vote. Upon point of order, you don't actually need a motion to call a point of order, and anybody can call a point of order. Usually I try to catch them, but oftentimes I don't because I'm maybe in the middle of recording votes or doing something in my minutes or whatever. And so I may miss a point of order. The mayor is well versed in parliamentary procedure, and he will oftentimes catch them, but you can catch a point of order also. And that would be something that maybe we aren't following procedure. Maybe we neglected to catch a second on a motion, or we forgot public comment. Anybody can call a point of order. And there's actually a process for that. So you would call point of order, and the mayor would ask you to state your point. And then you would do so, and the mayor would rule whether that point of order is well taken or not. And usually it's something that, yeah, we missed and we need to backtrack and start doing things correctly. And then there's bring back motions, and there's rules for these as well in the columns to the right. You can, you know, reconsider something that's already been adopted. You can rescind something, you can amend something previously adopted. And take something from the table. That's actually an interesting one that I should mention, because oftentimes that gets confused with postponing something indefinitely. And so laying something on the table would be a subsidiary motion. So there might be a motion at hand, and maybe a presenter shows up who was supposed to present during committee staff reports, and they were late and they missed their item on the agenda at that time, and we've moved on down the list. If that person shows up, a council member can make a motion to lay whatever you're dealing with on the table to let this presenter present instead of keeping them waiting. The important thing when you do something like that is to pick it back up from the table as a bring back motion during that same meeting. Otherwise, that will kill the motion. It'll die. Sometimes people will want to lay something on the table thinking that they're killing the motion, but that instead would be, if you want to kill a motion that's on the table, you would postpone that indefinitely. That's how you kill a motion. So those two oftentimes get confused. And motions can be confusing in itself. So if you have any questions, now you can ask me. If you have any questions ever about a motion that you're thinking about making or amendment that you're making in the future, you can call me and ask me or email me and we can talk about it. And I'm happy to help. But I'll take any questions now if you have any now about motions. Okay, are you guys awake? Have I put you to sleep yet?
Madam Clerk, this is the mayor. This is a great table, and this is a subject that was covered in, well, also in the training that I did online from AML that I hope the rest of you will. And it's covered in various means in the binder that the clerk has given us each as council members. So I urge you to read through those sections in that binder if you haven't done so yet. And you'll see material that approaches this from various means, and I think it'll help you build an understanding of how we need to process our way through these through motions and so forth in our meetings. So this is just a good opportunity for me to remind everybody to go through the material in that binder. There's a lot of great stuff there that you'll find helpful. Thanks.
Bella, I saw that you had your hand up. Did you have a question?
I was just clapping so that you knew that I was awake.
Okay. All right. Moving on to Open Meetings Act, otherwise known as OMA. All meetings must be open to the public. All meetings must be open to the public. That being said, what is a meeting? OMA has defined it as a gathering of governmental body when more than three members or a majority of members, whichever is less, are present and a matter upon which the governmental body is empowered to act is considered by the members collectively. So there's no particular format for determining when a gathering becomes a meeting under the OMA. Therefore, if a sufficient number of members are present, more than three, any gathering may become a meeting subject to the OMA. This could be email, potlucks, or even the 4th of July celebration if more than three council members are discussing matters that upon which the council is empowered to act. So the rule of thumb here is three is free. Oftentimes, like currently we have the endowment fund grant committee, that's three council members. So that does not require it to be a public meeting. It doesn't need to be noticed. Three is free. But it can get sticky sometimes, and that's why why in my emails that I send to you, I am constantly reminding you not to reply to all, because emails can be considered a meeting. If you are exchanging an email with all the council members and you guys are replying to each other, that's essentially a meeting, and we can't do that behind closed doors. You want to use your city email only for city business. Actually, can I backtrack just a second here? I didn't offer you an opportunity to ask any questions about Open Meetings Act. I just kind of moved right into email. It was a great transition to email, but do any of you have any questions about the Open Meetings Act? You should have all read the document in your checklist, but it can be confusing, and sometimes I'm still even confused by it. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, thanks for mentioning that famous Gordon Tan's paper. It's fairly lengthy, but it's really important, and because the Open Meetings Act is very complicated as it's been interpreted. And Tan's did a fabulous job in going through and developing this document that is a guidance document for everybody across the state. And there's a lot of really interesting things on it. And something I noticed today that may contradict, and I had never thought of it before, but may contradict what Karen said about the endowment fund subcommittee. And it says that if you have a subcommittee of the council and you have a majority of the subcommittee meeting to conduct the business of that subcommittee, that it probably has to be noticed. And that's something that we should probably talk about more internally, the clerk and I, to make sure that what our interpretation ought to be on that. But by reading that document, it really caused me to think more carefully about those issues for subcommittees. Now, he does point out, of course, that committees that are not of the city, like the Ad Hoc Beach Community Committee that came to us with their recommendations, they aren't covered, nor are, say, the community center and NGOs that we may deal with. They're not covered by the Open Meetings Act. I think we all need to read this document pretty carefully to have an understanding of what some of the implications are. And it's actually pretty interesting reading. He covers also ex parte functions of the council, which maybe Karen's gonna cover, maybe not, but that's an important consideration because ex parte considerations apply when you have a quasi-judicial function. So quasi-judicial functions, I learned in the AML training, can include things like making a decision on whether to question a liquor license renewal, for example. It's also apparently, I asked specifically at that meeting whether it would apply to when the city council meets as an election review committee. And the lawyer who responded to my question said, not for that unless you have a contested election. Then it becomes maybe a quasi-judicial function. And so you need to read carefully what he has to say about quasi-judicial functions. And you'll see some other references to that in some of the other materials in your binder. I've learned just recently that I need to identify things that may be quasi-judicial in our agenda and make sure that everybody knows not to have discussions outside of the council meeting with or do any investigations of that quasi-judicial matter outside of the council meeting. And we only deal with it with what we learn in the council meeting. So there are some things like that that we'll probably try to do a much better job of going forward now that I've, I think, a better understanding of it. Thanks.
Okay, that was an interesting rabbit hole. I would like to talk more about the committees. Majority thing that you mentioned in the Open Meetings Act document. There's a lot of information in that document and does need to be read carefully, and I don't actually find it particularly interesting like you do. So I have to read it like 5 times because I've daydreamed, after the second paragraph, I start daydreaming. But yes, I'd like to talk more about that with you. Any other questions about Open Meetings Act? Okay, so yes, use city email only for city business. Do not send emails to the entire council. Send them through the clerk to be sent to the entire council. I send these emails out to the entire council with usually the mayor, the vice mayor, and the city administrator in the address line, and then everybody else is BC blank copied. And when you respond to those emails, do not respond to all, because then you're going to be responding to all the blind copy people in that blind copy address line, and that would be a violation of the Open Meetings Act. Do not delete your email. Organize your email by creating folders. Some of you may not know how to do this. If you need help organizing your email into folders, I am happy to provide help with you for that. Anytime during business hours, of course, Monday through Thursday, 9 to 4. Your emails need to be archived. They're public record. And this is kind of a little bit vague area, but share emails that you think might be important for the clerk, the mayor, the city administrator, or even all the other council members would be important for them to know about. We don't necessarily need to, you know, see every email correspondence. That would be TMI, but there are things that should be shared, and I'll just leave that up to you guys to, you know, decide what needs to be shared and what doesn't, but please do not delete anything. Your emails are public record and they need to be archived and organized. Are there any questions about email? Tanya.
So we get a lot of emails and can't reply all to everyone else on the council. How do we know who replies to who? You know, it seems like, you know, we want to reply to people, but we don't all need to reply to people. But is there any way, any method for knowing who has replied to someone yet?
Could you give me a specific example? Or, I mean, are you just, like, for example, maybe today we had an email from a community member that wanted a response from everybody?
I actually didn't get that one. I did not get that, which I heard about it. So maybe I can check with you. But yeah, so that's a good example, except most people don't say, I want a response from everyone. Like, that's kind of easy, then everyone responds. But if, I know in the past year, it seemed like the mayor would respond pretty often, but maybe not always, but we wouldn't know that. And I mean, it's a lot of work, I know, to just, for the clerk, for you to be like, you know, sharing every single email we share. But I was just wondering if there's any system of for us to know if someone's been responded to yet, because I feel like it'd be ideal if we could respond to every letter, and if we had a way of like tag teaming, you know, it'd be most efficient. But maybe that's something we can just kind of work towards if we agree that that's kind of room for improvement, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely room for improvement there. There's no system in place, and it has been different with each mayor. Some mayors choose not to respond to letters that come in, and some mayors have responded to each and every letter that we've received. And some mayors have just not, you know, have responded to some, but not all. So there is no process right now for that. And yeah, I would love to work towards something that would be more efficient and consistent. So yeah, that doesn't really answer your question. No, there is no process. There's no way of knowing.
Yeah, this is Mike. I admit to being inconsistent myself. And I think this is something I should probably work on with the city clerk here and see if we can come up with some way to be more consistent. I know sometimes people in the community email us directly, maybe only as one council member. They just think they'd like to suggest something to a council member. They're interested in a trail somewhere, or they've something about road maintenance and that kind of thing. And I think council members, of course, should feel free to respond to the inquiry or comment by the person if you think it calls for a response. If they're suggesting, you know, it's just here's an idea, don't respond, then that's fine. But if you feel that you'd like to respond to somebody who's written to you, then I think that's fine. If it's something that you think maybe of any controversy or whatever, probably we should copy the clerk so she's aware of it, as she suggested. And maybe if I respond, if there's something that goes to all council members and I respond, I'll ask the clerk to forward that response to the rest of you so you know what I have said. Not that you have to agree with me. You can certainly have a different view, but I'll at least let you all know that I responded. And so I take that as a great comment, Tanya. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. And Tanya, yeah, Tanya, I sent that email. I just double checked that I didn't, you know, accidentally not include you in the BCC line. I sent that 11:30 this morning, so you may not have seen it. Alrighty. So moving on to conflicts of interest. This is something that at times has come up quite often. I'm in a small municipality. So it's in our code, a city official or employee may not participate in any official action on a city contract or financial appropriation in which he or she or a member of his or her family, household, business, colleague, or associate has a substantial financial interest. So yeah, like I said, conflicts of interest are not unusual, especially in a rural community. Not involve substantial financial interest, and some conflicts may only appear to be improper. You can declare that another council member may have a conflict. So sometimes we don't even realize, you know, we're just so involved in taking care of city business and you forget, you know, that maybe, oh, this might not be appropriate for me to be voting on because I have a financial interest, you know, my wife has a financial interest in or something, whatever. You might not even think about it. And another council might be wondering like, what's going on here? Maybe this doesn't seem quite right. You can declare it a conflict that you think another council member may have. If you're unsure, maybe you think you might have a conflict, declare it. Or if you're thinking in advance of the meeting before it happens and you think, oh, I might have a conflict here, you can call me, you can ask me, you can call Tom, you can talk to the mayor and we'll help you figure it out. If you do have a conflict of interest, you would declare it and the hearing would take place. And these don't usually take that long. It sounds scarier than it actually is. A formal hearing can take place at a work session, again, because we can't take any action at a work session. If a conflict is declared at a work session, your participation in that work session might be limited until a formal decision can be made in a public hearing. So the mayor would conduct the public hearing at the next general meeting, or if there's a special meeting that's scheduled, being scheduled, it could happen there too. So you would start by declaring your conflict, and then the mayor would ask you to provide a statement regarding your conflict. And then the mayor would determine whether a conflict exists or not. If a conflict exists, the mayor may invite you to participate in the discussion, but not allow you to vote on the matter. The council can override the decision that's being made by the mayor by a motion. So if you don't agree, you can make a motion to override that decision. I go back again. Are there any questions about conflicts?
Yeah, this is Mike again. I'd like to add a couple things here. This was covered quite extensively in our new officials training from AML. And there's some fine points that they sometimes go back and forth on. But one thing in all the direction that I've seen from the state, and conflict of interest is covered in state statute. And so we try to follow that. And for the definition of conflict of interest that is that we're given is that there has to be a substantial financial interest. The council member must have a substantial financial interest in the outcome of the matter under discussion. And if they don't have, then they don't have a conflict of interest. Now, if that financial interest is, if you have a financial interest that's the same as everybody else or a large portion of the community, such as say we're voting on whether to dole out funds from the CARES Act and everybody's gonna get that, you may be getting one of those checks, but so is everybody else. So your interest is no different from everybody else. And so you don't have a conflict of interest in a case like that. But if you own a business that is going to have there's a contract up for, say you're in road maintenance or something, and then you have to declare a conflict of interest on that. The direction that they gave us in the AML training was that a council member who has a conflict of interest may not even participate in the discussion. However, they do have a First Amendment right to free speech. And so if they really do want to say something about it, they can leave the council table and sit in the audience and make a comment as an audience member. But they have to identify themselves as such, as a private person making that conflict or that comment. We have occasionally had something like that come up, but it's really pretty rare. But an important thing, though, is that if you don't have a conflict of interest, then you must vote. You can't recuse yourself. And the reason for that is to prevent council members from avoiding a difficult vote, having to vote on something that maybe they've got a close friend who's going to be really PO'd at them for making that vote. And so they might try to excuse themselves from voting. You're not allowed to do that under state law. So if we don't have a substantial financial interest in it, or if we're found not to have a substantial financial interest and hence a conflict of interest, then we do have a duty to participate in the discussion and vote. So there's more information on that, I think, in our binder, and in there certainly is some in the little pamphlet that I think our binder has up front on council member duties and so forth. There's a discussion of some of that in there. I encourage you to read up on it. These things do come up several times a year. So it's important for us all to have a pretty good understanding of what constitutes a conflict of interest. Oh, one place where you might get out of voting or participating is in an ex parte situation where you find yourselves meeting as a quasi-judicial board on something like a liquor license, and you've had a discussion, say, with the party with an interest in the hearing, maybe not even knowing it was going to come up, but you have a special background on that. You may at that point be able to or be required to declare that you have kind of a conflict with that, and you may be excused from voting on that basis. But that's an unusual situation, but it can come up. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. But actually what you mentioned there about being required to vote conflicts with our policy and procedure. So I would like to talk to you more about that.
Certainly.
Yeah. It allows in our policy procedure for you to make a determination if a conflict exists to allow for the council member to participate in the discussion, but recuse himself from voting. So that would be an interesting discussion for us to have, maybe at another time, and come back to the council with information on that. I was just looking it up while you were talking, and anyways, yeah, a conversation for another time. So are there any other questions? I probably generated more questions about conflict of interest. Tanya?
I don't have a question, just a reminder. There's a few of us that work for the park, and we have our own potential conflict of interest from work. So that's kind of a totally separate thing, but just putting it out there that there might be other reasons that we abstain from certain discussions or projects or votes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, that would be an interesting one to address, and it's not the kind of thing, in other words, you could have your employer may preclude you from discussing something. And that's not something that's covered under the law and the direction for us. It's an interesting thing to figure out how to deal with, but that would probably be in conflict with the state law, I would think, if the person tried to recuse themselves for a reason like that. But it's worth getting some direction from the city attorney on. And by the way, we have gone back and forth at times on whether we should be allowed to, or whether a person with a conflict of interest should be allowed to comment on the item on the agenda without voting. Ryan Wilson promoted that idea when he was our representative from DCCED as a matter of First Amendment rights. But the direction of the lawyers in the training that I attended for the state was contrary to that. So something that has certainly gone back and forth. We've done it both ways.
Okay. So social media, that's another interesting conundrum that we have. We have three social media sites for our municipality. They are all Facebook. We have a city page, a city hall page, an emergency operations center, EOC page, and a library page. So this is just kind of a reminder that city business should be conducted through city outlets. City business should not be conducted on your personal social media pages. If you, oh gosh, I'm looking at two different screens. It's weird. It's like showing me the next slide. So I was looking at the wrong screen just now. If you must comment on a social media site, do so as an individual, not as a city representative. Okay. Those are kind of the three, four things that I want you to remember about social media. I think that's all I have to say about that. Basically, our Facebook pages, the city and the EOC page and the library, they are all informational, one-way informational Facebook pages. And that's what the intention is of those pages. We do not want to see them turn into the rumor mill. Do you guys have any questions about social media? Okay. So we'll move on to records retention then. What is records retention? Basically everything. The social media that we have, email, any documents you create, but it's more clearly defined. The records retention schedule is more clearly defined as a document that lists all the different types of city documents, and it defines how long we retain each of those specific documents and how each type of document is disposed of. So, you know, some things may be confidential, like employee records or tax documents. Those, you know, it would tell you that they need to be shredded. Other documents that aren't confidential, they can be recycled, or, you know, electronic documents would, of course, need to be disposed of a different way. And this schedule tells me exactly how long I'm to keep things. Some things I have to keep as long as 25 years. Some things I have to keep forever. Some things I only have to keep for 30 days. And you'll see on this next meeting, general meeting, I have a certificate of records destruction. And this is based off of these, it'll be a list of documents that are scheduled for destruction. And the way that I have determined that is through this records retention schedule. What is considered to be a record? So regardless of the format, anything leading to ordinance, policy, guidelines, procedure, certifying transactions, become receipt or indicate the business process of the city, whether it's email, you know, a Word document, no matter, you know, whatever it is, maybe it's a recording of a meeting, that's public record. What is to be considered a non-record? Again, regardless of the format, tends to be informational by nature, short-lived, with no historical significance, does not show evidence of municipality, and does not need to be retained after it has served its purpose. And why do we have a records retention schedule? It ensures that business is in compliance with state law. And it also ensures that we have easy access to records of historical value and needed records while not being overburdened with unneeded records. When I first started as clerk in 2017, I don't know, we might have had 100 boxes of records, and that just needed to be gone through. And I'm sure whoever had this position before me just did not have the time to do it. It was one of those duties that probably just fell by the wayside. And we spent months going through all of these boxes, getting rid of duplicates, pulling things that you know, may have historical value, because these records tell our history, you know, Gustavus history. And so I have a lot of records that I've kept forever, that I hope whoever comes after me will keep forever. And some things, there were just a lot of duplicates, and the whole back room, Tom's office, the fire hall, the old preschool, there were boxes everywhere. And so I've made quite a bit of headway in that project. There's still more work to do, but it's all basically in the closet here at City Hall now. So it's a big project. And everything that you do as a council member is pretty much public record. So I want you to keep that stuff organized. If you need help coming up with a system, I'm happy to help you. And that's all I have to say about records retention. Are there any questions there? I just have a few more topics, three more to go over, and then we're done. Do you guys have any questions about records retention? Okay. Because you're asleep, isn't it? All right, moving on to the resolutions. Tom and I think the mayor maybe touched a little bit on resolutions. And I just have a few short things to say about resolutions. Black's Law Dictionary defines it as a formal expression of an opinion, intention, or decision by an official body. Resolutions are introduced in writing and orally read before the vote is taken in the same meeting. So unlike an ordinance that gets introduced at one meeting and then a public hearing in a second meeting, resolutions are introduced and adopted in the same meeting. And it is in our ordinance that we need to read that aloud at the meeting. So that's why we do that with resolutions. You'll never see a resolution on a consent agenda item. They also become effective upon adoption. And resolutions are maintained and archived as a permanent record. Resolutions, you know, you can adopt a, or you can draft a, any council member can draft a resolution. I provided you with templates for resolutions and ordinances and policies on your computer as a desktop folder. At some point in your time as council member, you'll probably eventually be drafting a resolution. And us here, Tom and myself, are available as staff members to help you in that when the time comes. Do you have any questions about resolutions? Okay. Moving on to ordinances then. Tom touched a little bit on that. Black's Law, defines that as an authoritative law, decree, and municipal regulation. So ordinances are kind of, there's three different types of ordinances. There's code, there's non-code, and there's emergency ordinances. Code ordinances are permanent in nature. So, you know, they are in effect over time. They establish rules of conduct that will be codified. And that's done through Municode, the company that Kyle had mentioned that he had spoke with at the conference. So that becomes codified and put into our code of ordinance that's available on our website. And then we also have a permanent copy here at City Hall on our bookcase. So then there's non-code ordinances. These are not permanent in nature. They're specific to a moment in time. And they will not be codified. They do not become part of our code of ordinance that's on our website. They are on our website though. All of our code is on the website, the non-code resolutions, those are all can be found on our website. The most common non-code ordinance that you guys will see are the treasurer moving money around in the in the budget. Those come up quite often. And so those are the kind of the most common non-code ordinances that you would see. Sometimes we have to do emergency ordinances, and that's a form of non-code ordinance. They are not permanent, and they're usually in extreme or unusual circumstances. And they're limited in duration for 60 days or less. There's no public hearing required for an emergency ordinance. So there's a process for adopting an ordinance. First, it's introduced at one general meeting or a special meeting. And oftentimes, if it's a non-code ordinance, that will go under the consent agenda. If it's something that would go into our municipal code, we would usually put that under new business, the introduction. Excuse me, I have to take a sip of water. So it's introduced at one general meeting and needs to be posted for a minimum of 5 days. Normally, we'll post it for a whole month, though. It'll get introduced at one meeting, and then the public hearing will take place at the next general meeting. And then the council will have an opportunity to amend it. They'll discuss it, have an opportunity to, you know, if there's any changes during that discussion, they can make an amendment. And then they can vote on it, adopting it or not. And it's maintained and archived as permanent record. And then it will also get codified into our municipal code by Unicode. I have one more topic after this, and then we're done. Are there any questions about ordinance? All right, the last thing is policy and procedure. And the policy and procedures describe city's intent in addressing specific situations and provides guidelines for related tasks. It's not legally binding for a formal recommendation, but a formal recommendation for uniformity and consistency. And policy and procedures are adopted by resolution. So our ordinances and our policy and procedures are all things that need some updating and cleaning up. And so if you, as a council member, are working on a policy and procedure, you would need to accompany that. It would need to be accompanied by a resolution. And so the resolution would be put forward to adopt the policy and procedure. So you'd have two separate documents. And that's all I have. Are there any questions on policy and procedures? All right. I'm done, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. That was a great set of slides and a nice coverage of things that are really important to how we operate. I thought of one last thing about how we operate that I thought I had to bring up, that it didn't occur to me to discuss earlier as we were talking about the structure of a second class city. As you're aware, we have in a second class city, you have seven council members, and one of those council members is elected by the council to be mayor. And the council is sort of the legislative branch of our government. The mayor has a split responsibility. The mayor is the sort of the leader of the council, or the chair of the meetings and so forth. But the mayor has a separate role as the city's chief administrative officer. And so the mayor is, the staff essentially reports to the mayor, and the mayor may, as we have done, may delegate to a city administrator most of those the staff oversight and duties. And so that's, of course, what we have for an arrangement here. But an important thing for the council is that is to remember that council members don't direct staff. It is important to get out and visit our workplaces and talk to our librarians and the fire chief about their operations and, you know, maybe what they need so that you understand those operations better. But please try to avoid getting into a situation where you're directing the staff member to do something. And that has occurred sometimes in the past in the city here. Staff members don't need 7 or 8 different bosses. And so it's real important to maintain that chain of command. And if you have something that you think a particular department ought to be directed to do, then please bring it to my attention and I'll be glad to discuss it with you and probably carry through what your idea is. But it is important to follow that chain of command and not get staff feeling that they're being managed by a committee. So does anybody have any questions about that? I just thought it was important to bring up, and I know it can be a touchy subject, so I'm sorry. Okay, well, if any of you want to discuss something like that with me sometime, feel free to give me a call. And also, while our ordinance says that two council members can bring something, can put something on the agenda for a council meeting, as far as I'm concerned, if just even one of you wants something on the agenda, I'll put it on, you know, whether it's something that I'm interested in myself or supporting or not, doesn't matter. If you want it on the agenda, ask me and I'll be glad to put it on. Thank you for sticking it out for 2 hours and 10 minutes. And I know we've got another meeting tomorrow night. It should go very quickly. It's just to pass or just to award 2 contracts for projects for road maintenance that we'd like to get done as soon as possible, if the snow goes away enough to make it possible. So I appreciate you being available tomorrow night for that meeting. And we've got one other item on it that has a deadline for grant money. So those 3 items should go very quickly. And I appreciate you being available for 2 nights in a row for these things. Does anybody have anything else they'd like to bring up for the rest of sounds, it looks like not. Maybe everybody's pretty tired of all this, but thanks again for your attention, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you.